This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And we're going to begin our discussion today with something that, you know, we might look up from our Main Street and see those contrails in the sky. Modern aviation is amazing, to say the least. But it had modest beginnings, and we're going to remember some of the more exciting moments in those beginnings with Glenn Blackaby. Glenn is the director of the Dakota Territory Air Museum in Minot, and he'll be giving a presentation about World War I pilots and their planes on Tuesday, July 24th at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby. He joins us by phone from Minot. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Doug.
Well, this year, 2018, marks the centennial of the end of World War I, so it's important to remember these moments in history. First of all, tell us about your museum in Minot.
A little about our museum. I'll give you a short version of the history. The Air Museum was actually organized in 1986. It obtained its first building about 1988. We added the second in 1989. But the museum struggled until a World War II vet from Surrey, North Dakota, Mr. Oswin Elker, he left a substantial benefit to the museum, and that resulted in a very important expansion. The Elker Wing was built in 2000, and that really moved the museum into a much better position. I would say with more display space, more attractions, and it really helped to place the museum beyond the early years of its struggles. We doubled in size in 2007 with the help of pledges from local business supporters, and then we added the new building, the Flying Legends Hangar, in 2013. Also, Warren Peach, one of our board members, has a connection to owners of a renowned collection of World War II airplanes. The owners of that collection were the benefactors that made possible our most recent expansion. And besides the collections, our mission is to be a vital historical aviation resource. And I won't say the whole motto, but it's to educate, inspire, and entertain people of all ages. And that is mostly fulfilled in our educational programs, what we call the ACE and PACE camps for kids, and the field trip tours that we get from the surrounding schools and youth organizations. Most of the field trips are from the local area and occasionally from as far as Williston, Stanley, and Dickinson, but we also have groups from Canada, Montana, and Minnesota. By the way, field trips are free. Each field trip goes on a report and sent into the NDAC. They provide us with grant money for our educational programs. I personally guided well over 700 children through the museum so far this year. Tours start with the Wright Flyer replica, and they can easily last an hour if that's what the teachers want, because there's just so much to see. Our ACE and PACE camps are especially rewarding. Responses from the kids on tour are always interesting, all the more so with the unpredictable little ones. There's those who get excited enough to interject with a story, pushing the envelope in terms of believability, but it puts a smile on our face, and it's part of the adventure that goes with giving tours.
World War I starts in 1915, and that's like a dozen years after the Wright brothers flew in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. So some amazing developments in aviation just up to that point. How would you describe the most important advances in aviation that were used in World War I?
The most important advances were, number one, the roles of the airplane. At the beginning of the war, in fact, many of the leaders in the Army were a hindrance. Their attitudes and their perspectives of the airplane were quite limited. And so there was some visionary pilots and leaders in the Flying Air Corps that pushed the envelope and brought about the role of the airplane. Its first role was a scout, and from that it developed into the other roles that it attained. And those roles became a pattern for the roles that would be in the airplane or be with the airplane through the 20th century.
Well, who had the best planes during World War I? Who had the best pilots?
The best planes that you had depended upon different phases of the war. The war went through phases. There was a period where that the Germans would have an advance. For instance, there was a period known as the Fokker Scourge, where the Eindecker stood out. There was another period where that the little Newport airplane began to take its place, and that entered into another phase. And then eventually we come to the DR-1, which the Germans have, and then we come back to the Sopwith Camel.
Well, how about those famous aces of World War I?
Yes, there's a lot of names there. Of course, everyone knows the Red Baron. Oh, but yeah. You also have the names, the Immelmann, you have Belke, and that was a German name. He was the guy that established doctrine during the war. And you have Fonck, you have, in the French side, you happen to have people like Geinemer, and you have Pinsard, you have Nungesser, you have Madon. Great Britain, you have Manet, you have Bishop, you have Koshaw, you have McCudden. Italy, you have Baracca. In the United States, you have Rickenbacker. And so, of course, I have already mentioned von Richthofen,
yeah.
Udet, and Voss, or which in German was probably the Voss, and Berthold, other names along that line.
Well, you had triplanes, biplanes, and single-wing aircraft in combat. What kind of training would a pilot have had before going on patrol in World War I?
In terms of training, it depended upon what phase of the war, but it was very limited. Part of that had to do with the exigencies that the war created, because sometimes they were so desperate for pilots that they were limiting the hours at which they could fly. Some of these guys were learning to fly in just a few hours, and then, of course, we were seeing the ramifications of that once they got into action. It was kind of a desperate measure there. And some of the pilots there, an expert on this, Mr. Richard Hallion, and he worked out that that during one phase of the war, the average for span for a pilot would be he would lose his life after 92 hours of flying.
Wow, that's a pretty dangerous role to be playing, in, even in wartime. So their inexperience was probably more deadly than machine gun fire, huh?
Yes, uh-huh.
How did the term dogfight come to describe aerial combat?
The term dogfight came to describe aerial combat in terms of the way dogs would fight. It was like a dog eat dog existence. Now there is a particular story that goes with that, and I'm sorry to say right now I can't remember the specifics of that story, but it brings out the humor and the specialty behind that name, dogfight.
Given the size and scope of World War I, millions of combatants, were airplanes actually significant in the outcome?
At the beginning, the airplane really was significant from the beginning, but it took a while before the leaders could see that.
Hmm. How did their use in World War I advance research and development leading up to World War II? Because there are huge changes. I mean, from the Wright brothers to World War I, from World War I to World War II, it's amazing how advanced things had become.
Yes, it did. There were three different ways in which the plane advanced. They went from weakness to strength. They also went from, there was stability versus instability, and toward the end of the war, they began to learn that instability in an airplane can actually be an advantage. It's almost like you would like to have a horse that is hard to handle, and that, of course, is dangerous, but once you learn to handle that horse, he actually is an advantage, and that's what they learned also from airplanes. They tried to leave the instable planes with the role of scout and reconnaissance, whereas the fighters, of course, developed the instable role. And then the other advancement was from pusher airplanes to tractor airplanes.
Okay, so the propellers in front or behind, right?
Mm-hmm, yes.
And one other important advance, at least for the pilot having to multitask when you're in a dogfight, is that the machine gun was actually firing through the propeller.
That basically started when... At the beginning, with it being inconceivable that you would actually try to fire a machine gun through a propeller, first of all, you had planes like the BE-2, where that you had an area for the pilot and you had an area for a gunner. The gunner was also a lot of times an observer, but that gunner would be placed in the front, and that plane was a pusher plane where the propellers were in the back. And they began to use the machine gun that way. One of the reasons for using the machine gun, because when they begin to realize that a scout plane... If you see an enemy scout plane, and when they first saw them, they'd be waving at each other. But that plane is going to return with information, and that information is going to change the whole panorama of the battlefield scene. And so In that case, they realized that we've got to stop that other plane from going back, and that's when they begin to try to mount machine guns on those planes. But then there was Roland Garros, who was a French pilot. He saw the advantage of a tractor plane with a propeller in front having machine gun. But the problem with that is he couldn't see that the feasibility of firing machine guns through the propeller. So what he did, he mounted some steel plates onto the propeller, and he tested this, and he fired it. And so he began to shoot down German airplanes, and that began a phase where the Germans were just, they first of all, they were in awe because a plane that's a tractor is somehow, it's bringing our planes down. And they couldn't figure it out until Mr. Garrow was shot down. And he tried to burn his plane up so that before they captured it so that he could keep the secret. But, of course, that didn't happen. And so the German authorities turned that plane over to Anthony Fokker. And then Anthony Fokker, with three other men, developed a synchronization gear. And the story behind that's quite humorous, and it's really entertaining.
Well, it's kind of interesting that the first version of this was just putting steel on the propeller because occasionally it would obviously hit the propeller.
Yes. Uh-huh.
These planes are canvas and cable and wood. How fast could they fly? How high could they fly?
Well, at the beginning of the war, the weaker airplanes were flying around that 90 miles per hour. But as you get later in the war and as planes developed, they were getting actually up to 130 miles per hour. And the height, they were going up in the early part of the war, it was around 5,000 to 7,000 feet. And later in the war, they were going up to 20,000 feet. In fact, at 20,000 feet, the pilots had to have oxygen, and their oxygen, they breathed through a rubber hose. And how they kept that hose in their mouth after so long a time, I do not understand, but that must have been a challenge.
Well, that was certainly important for World War II technology. And you mentioned that these pilots, at first somewhat inexperienced and occasionally waving each other, they've sometimes been referred to as knights of the air, and then they got, you know, pretty pugilistic about sharing that airspace. What kind of relationship or appreciation did pilots have for each other, even on opposing forces?
They did have some appreciation. In fact, of course, when von Richthofen was finally shot down, respect for him on the Allied side was so great that there was, of course, his body was retained on the Allied side, and so they had the funeral on that side, and they gave him quite a ceremony. The other thing, too, is a lot of times when pilots were shot down, the Germans did this for the Allies, and the Allies did this for, I should say, the Central Powers, and they would fly over with notes to tell to if the person had survived. Sometimes they would leave a note to the other side to say he's okay or he's in prison. So there's a certain amount of chivalry that you can see there.
Do you have World War I vintage aircraft on display at the Dakota Territory Air Museum in Minot?
No, we don't. In fact, the earliest planes that we have here were built in 1929. We have two from 1929, but one of those has an OX-5 engine in it, and that is a 1918 World War I engine that uses castor oil.
Wow. So there are World War I aircraft that remain, of course. Are any of them still airworthy?
Yes. In fact, in Owl's Head, Maine, at least in the past, and I've been there, they used to put on an air show where they would fly planes like the Bleriot and some of the German planes and some of the Allied planes. And each year at the old Rhinebeck Airdrome in New York, they have on every weekend, they have a display and flights of World War I airplanes. And what's so interesting about that is when the planes come in to land, they don't even have a throttle setting that they could slow the plane down. So they have to blip the engine on and off, on and off, on and off to gradually slow it down and bring it down to the field.
Well, how much of a field would an aircraft take during World War I to land or take off?
You know, I don't know the exact distance of that. I do know, though, that a lot of them had a tail skid, and their brakes were not effective if they had brakes at all. And so you will see, in fact, you can watch this in some of the old films, that the crewmen will surround that airplane, they will put their hands on it and wrap their arms around the stabilizers and hold the plane back while the pilot revs up the engine, and then at some point he gives a signal and he lets go. And that, of course, that gives him a little initial boost there for acceleration.
And they weren't landing on pavement. They were landing on what looked like rolling fields to me.
Yeah, rolling fields and dirt, yes.
Okay.
And that's why you see so much dust. And I'm sure the guys that were the crewmen around that area were very dusty.
Glenn Blackaby is the director of the Dakota Territory Air Museum in Minot. He'll be speaking at the Prairie Village Museum in Rugby on Tuesday, July 24th. It starts at 5:30 p.m. that evening. And it's World War I Pilots and Their Planes, the title of the presentation. There'll be a little food there if you get there in time. So, Glenn, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate you having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, an excerpt from StoryCorps featuring storyteller Kevin Locke.
Hi, I'm Ashley Thornburg. I hope you'll join me at the North Dakota Heritage Center Thursday, July 19th, to celebrate the Oral History Project StoryCorps and their time in North Dakota, recording stories inside their iconic Airstream mobile recording booth. Meet the people behind StoryCorps and all share select stories from your friends and neighbors about the people and experiences that have shaped their lives. So celebrate StoryCorps with Prairie Public Thursday, July 19th from 6:30 to 7:30 inside the Russell Reed Auditorium at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Kevin Locke is a Lakota and Anishinaabe storyteller, recording artist, educator, and flute player. He is most known for his hoop dance. Locke told his story to Madison Mullen of StoryCorps. The Oral History Project is now recording in Bismarck. In this excerpt, we hear how he learned the dance from Arlo Goodbear.
He told me, Brother, this dance that I have, this hoop dance that I have, he says, I'm going to give this dance to you. I'm going to give you four lessons on this dance. One lesson now, and I'll give you the rest later. He says, through this dance, you'll be able to meet many people, see many places, many different places. You're going to receive abundant blessings. So many blessings are going to come to you. Just right out of the blue, he just got up, did a few designs. That whole lesson probably lasted maybe all of 10 minutes at the most. A week or 2 weeks after that, he was in an accident and died. I had several very vivid dreams. I saw him laying in this casket, the way he was dressed so beautifully, you know, the way they had prepared his body. Then all of a sudden his eyes opened up. He took off right out of that casket, turned, and he really smiled. Took off, went right up into the sun, where I'd see him dancing. Basically an audio experience, sensory experience. And I heard a beautiful song, really beautiful song. And as that song began to kind of pick up in tempo and in volume and intensity, then a little bit of light came right in the middle there, and I could see he was dancing there. As he began to do that, then the light began to come out. People were gathered all around, but they were very downcast, downtrodden, dispirited, so burdened with life, you know, horrible condition, sadness and brokenheartedness. And then as he began to pick up more hoops and he began to create designs portrayed like springtime, this radiance began to become manifest upon the people in their countenance and their beings, efflorescence, blossoming, like all these latent talents, fleet-footedness and endurance, and these things began to slowly appear, and I could see this, you see. Maybe he'd make designs of birds like eagles that could soar, kind of representing the ascendant nature of the human spirit. He'd make designs of mountains, you know, representing like the majesty and our birthright of being put into this world to manifest noble qualities, you know. But the springtime that he was portraying was a springtime that autumn can never overtake, when the collective spirit of humankind begins to blossom. And this is what I saw. And then the dreams ceased. I kind of flashed in my mind what he had told me, that he said he was going to give me four lessons. I thought he was going to give me like practical, you do this and this and this, but that was totally not what I got. What I got was a vision of what it represents. It's a prayer that we could be restored into the real world. I met this man maybe 40, 50 years ago. So I went to see him, And he's one of the old school hoop dancers from South Dakota, Leonard Crow Dog. So I asked him about this dance. I says, Le changalesh kawa chikile, e hani oyate, hanke hawayate, tuktetan he chupi. Na niecha, toon spenichiap, tuktetan yachu he. I said, this dance that we have, this hoop dance, the people of old times, where did they receive this? This dance, he said, it doesn't come from this world right here. This world, this shadow world that we are experiencing now, this dark place that we live in right now. He says, this dance comes from out there. It comes from that world of light, the world of beauty, the world that never fades. He says, the same place that we all come from. He says, even adults forget. They attach themselves to this world, this dark place that we live in. They think this has permanence. You know, every time I do this dance, I think people from the, I'll just say dominant culture. You know, they would say we're colonized here in our own land. You know, we were taken over, invaded by aliens. Everybody's illegal on stolen land, right? Anyway, so when people do this dance, they always put it in the category of entertainment. Because you see, in the dominant culture, the arts are relegated, kind of use the arts. They use music and everything to escape their reality. We use the arts to do the opposite, to connect with reality, to connect with that which is good, to remove the barriers, artificial barriers that we perceive might block us out from our ancestral heritage. The barriers we see between ourselves and maybe like the natural environment there, that's gone. The barriers we see between ourselves interpersonally, that all disappears, you see, through the arts. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The hoop is the world's most universal, world's most ubiquitous archetype. So for all peoples on the planet, it represents everything good, everything holy, everything with continuity, everything with order, harmony, balance, everything that's unified, everything real, see? No corner. There's no dark place to get left out, no place to hide, no back row, second, third row. It's all front row seats, you see. You're allowing those ancestral voices to speak. This doesn't belong to me. It's a universal expression, connects that universal reality, the world of light, and it brings us into that world of light. I couldn't possibly care less about conveying a culture-specific or tribal-specific message. Only thing I want to do is just to reinforce who we are as human beings, you know, those things that connect all of us. That's it.
Locke has shared his hoop dance with people in 96 countries. The interview was recorded at the StoryCorps mobile booth at the Heritage Center in Bismarck. StoryCorps is a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Prairie Public. Our thanks to Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck for helping sponsor the StoryCorps visit to North Dakota. StoryCorps is in Bismarck until July 27th, and you can reserve your spot in the StoryCorps booth at prairiepublic.org. Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern. Sue Belcom joins us to talk about growing garlic, and Ashley Thornburg and I will look at our What's Happening entertainment calendar. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The president of the Council of College Faculties has been named to Governor Burgum's Task Force for Higher Education Governance. Dr. Deborah Dragseth of Dickinson State University will replace Bismarck State College Institutional Research Analyst Dr. Ellie Shockley. Dr. Shockley recently changed jobs, causing a conflict of interest. Dragseth becomes the voting member, while Shockley will remain on the task force in a non-voting capacity. Dragseth says she's excited about being on the task force. She says there are some issues she considers to be non-negotiable.
One is academic freedom. You know, that's really important that that be a part of any new or tweaked governance model that we put together. And also, you know, the faculty input, faculty governance, shared governance is really critical to any higher education system.
Dragseth says she also wants to make sure that campus identity and individuality aren't sacrificed in any new governance model.
We don't want 11 cookie-cutter campuses, so it's a fine balance of keeping each campus unique and mission-driven and serving that community that campus resides in,
The task force meets Monday in Fargo. A lot of state agencies have asked for extensions on submitting their proposed budgets to the Office of Management and Budget for the 2019-2021 biennium.
More than normal, I would say.
State Budget Director Joe Morissette told the legislature's budget section part of the reason for the extensions is the extra strategy review sessions OMB has had with the agencies.
I mean, agencies kind of waited until after their strategy review meeting was over to see if that would impact how they develop their budget. And so I think we'll have to look at that time frame in the future. And if we have a similar process 2 years from now, we probably need to move that up and have those strategy reviews take place a little sooner so that we don't have this issue of budgets, you know, the majority of budgets, 62 out of 73 being extended.
In his budget guidelines to the agencies, Governor Burgum asked smaller agencies to cut 5% and larger agencies to cut 10%. The governor will give his executive budget to the legislature in December. And a sports drink company will receive a $160,000 low-interest loan from the Grand Forks Job Development Authority to help relocate from Lincoln, Nebraska, to Grand Forks. The city council, meeting as the JDA, approved the loan this week for Crampade. Economic Development Corporation President Keith Lund says the firm is looking to set up a production facility in the industrial park.
Their target markets include athletically induced cramping, menstrual cramping, and others with chronic cramping issues. The project of companies undertaking is to establish a full-scale production facility in Grand Forks, which will include building modifications, equipment, working capital.
Crampade will also tap a bank, personal, and a North Dakota Development Fund loan to finance the $490,000 project. The company expects to create 11 new jobs. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is an NDSU professor and a longtime student of history. He's also a writer of books and of the Plainsfolk essays you hear on Main Street. Today, his essay is titled, The Glorious Fourth in McLeod.
Independence Day, the Glorious Fourth, has always been a favorite of mine, but this year, my Suzanne and I were left without a plan for the holiday. We had no family around, and it seemed sort of pointless to buy fireworks and mix homemade ice cream just for ourselves. The situation pointed us back to the heyday of 4th of July on the prairies, when community events, not backyard barbecues, were the order of the day. Some elements of this community tradition have been allowed, mercifully, to lapse. I'm talking about the long-winded bouts of patriotic oratory that used to hold crowds sweating for hours. Other community traditions of the glorious Fourth persist in truth and purity. For these, we went seeking. We looked for a community that punched above its weight, a tiny town with a big parade. The selection narrowed to Forbes at the foot of the Coteau in Dickey County, or McLeod in the sandhills of Ransom County. McLeod won out, mainly by reason of distance. McLeod, population 27, has an interesting efflorescence going on. A few years ago, a flash pub, the Silver Prairie Saloon, opened up in town and became a dining destination. I figured this would be the death of the Sand Dune Saloon across the street, but not so. A year or so ago, Jerry and June Olerud took it over, revived its spirit of hospitality, and made it a lively, alternative place. Nobody ever called the Sand Dune flash, but people like the atmosphere. McLeod, as a community, too, specializes in events that draw crowds. Coming up this Saturday, the 14th, is the third annual McLeod Classic Tractor Stampede, a procession of vintage machinery through the Sandhills. A larger event, the Cowboy Up Ride Against Cancer, will be the 17th and 18th of August. And, of course, there was the parade on the Glorious Fourth. Cars and trucks and motorbikes lined the main drag while the parade participants queued up on the gravel road north of town. Regulars set up their lawn chairs in their regular places. Come parade time, the two saloons disgorged their patrons onto the sidewalks. I quickly lost count of parade entries, but if you ask our favorite, it was the modest contribution of the Lidgerwood Camera Club, now in its 64th year. Its float was a black Kodak Brownie camera on wheels. I think the crowd favorite was the El Zago Viking ship because it's so adorably hokey. As for the political partisans, the Democrats bested the Republicans, with two spiffy Uncle Sams working the crowd. Following the parade and some dutiful hydration at the Sandhill, we made our way to McLeod's remarkable community museum, a complex of buildings staffed by volunteers. They have some great artifacts, among which I gravitate to the agricultural pieces, and particularly to one, a homemade grass seed harvester. I don't want to get too wonky about this, but it is a story I will return to another time. How in the 1940s, Ransom County operators harvested the seed to sow military airfields in Alaska. We wound up the day with a grand hike through the Burr Oak savannas of the Cheyenne National Grassland, which led to a little beaver pond that delighted our canine companions. Angie the history dog swam and swam. Willa the book beagle doesn't swim, but she was fascinated by the engineering of the beaver dam and gave it a thorough inspection. It was a glorious fourth.
That's Tom Ezard. Next on Main Street, some garlic growing tips.
We were able to take whatever we could carry in our two hands.
At the beginning of World War II, the United States government forced more than 100,000 Japanese Americans into prison camps.
We thought we were American citizens, therefore we were protected by the Constitution to continue to have the freedom, the liberty that all Americans have a right to.
Listen for Order 9066 from APM Reports.
Order 9066 from APM Reports. This week's Prairie Public Presents. Coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio, Sue Balcom with the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan.
Thanks, Sue. We always appreciate having you in.
Oh, it's almost so much fun because we get to talk about food, my favorite subject.
And coming up in the gardens, so much fantastic garlic and the garlic scapes. For those not familiar, what is a garlic scape?
Well, every plant comes to a stage in their development where they kind of start sending out seedlings. And so in a garlic garden, you get these long, skinny, curly things growing up out of the center with the seed bulb on the end of them. And lately, people have been discovering them at their local farmers' markets because they are delightful.
Are they garlic-like?
They are very garlic-like, and you can use them in recipes just like you can garlic, but you can also make some other extraordinary things like garlic scape pesto, which is, oh, it is so fantastic with raw vegetables. And, of course, we don't quite have little baby carrots yet, but that's one of my favorites is pesto. And it's kind of like pesto made with basil, but it's got a nice, deep, rich garlic flavor to it. Oh, it's amazing, and it keeps the vampires away.
Are you wanting to mince that then, or how do you mix it in with the pesto?
Actually, you use the garlic instead of the basil, or you can mix half garlic and half basil in your little food processor with pine nuts and or walnuts. It depends on what you like. And, of course, your usual black pepper, a little salt, a little grated Parmesan cheese, and some olive oil. And then it's really good chilled because the flavors have a chance to marry if you put it in the refrigerator. But you can find tons of recipes for garlic scape pesto online.
So this kind of extends the usefulness of the garlic plant.
Absolutely, because as you know, garlic is planted in the fall, usually around October 14th or 15th.
You're very precise.
Yes, and you know what I found out? That I have other people who, like one of my friends is like, well, I plant mine on the 12th of October. Well, fine. It's 2 days earlier than mine because you have to harvest garlic come up probably, the end of July. Or very shortly after the scapes. Now, one of the reasons you cut those scapes off of there is so that the garlic puts all its energy into creating a big old fat bulb.
Oh, okay.
So you plant garlic in the fall and you mulch it up real good with straw. And then in the spring, it comes up whenever it wants to. So it's a fairly easy crop to grow. And I think everybody had to grow it back in the day because you can't make a good sausage without making a garlic water the night before you butcher. So it was very important to have garlic.
At the end of the scape where that final little curl is, there's always a little bulge. And I think you called it a seed bulb or a seed pod or something. Can you eat that part?
Yeah, you could because we eat just about anything. But I would recommend cutting that off and also picking your scapes when they're quite young. And I know that you can't see me, but the garlic scapes that grow up in my garden kind of remind me of my hair. They curl just like a naturally curly hair would. So
how long are they? As long as your naturally curly hair?
Well, I wish mine were longer than – I wish mine were equally as strong as a garlic scape, but they're
right.
– But it's not.
So hard with curly
so,
hair.
I know. It's so fine. Anyway, they're probably from 6 to 12 inches long, and some of them are curled more than once. Like some get crazy curly, and then some of them are a little bit tougher. Most people up here in North Dakota grow hard neck garlic. The soft neck garlic doesn't do well in our climate. And elephant garlic, while it's really fun to grow, doesn't have as much garlic flavor as either the scapes that we grow and or the garlic. Hmm. So if you go to your farmer's market, and we get lots of questions about this too. People are like, what is that stuff anyway? And we're like, you got to try it because you can grill them. You can make hummus. You can make a compound butter. You can saute them and eat them as a side dish to a good grilled steak or something. And you can actually make them, you know, put them in your soup. I put them in my sourdough bread. People like that garlic bread for garlic toast in the summertime. They're really kind of cool.
So it gives a little garlic flavor and a green highlight? Is that what it does?
Yes, it does. And so I know green food isn't always the most pleasant to look at, but if you like garlic, you have to try garlic scapes.
So anything you'd use garlic for, you could use a garlic scape for?
Yes, and I actually chop them up and throw them in a bag and freeze them so then I can use them in my bread all winter long. You can grind them up real fine in a food processor and, you know, mix them with just about anything that you would garlic.
And we usually use it for savory things, but how about sweet?
Oh, I don't know, but I remember having a conversation with you guys about ice cream not too long ago. And I have heard that there is garlic ice cream. Ashley, have you tried that?
I would. I definitely would.
And I'd
so
watch
any
her try
ice cream
it.
Makers out there, if you want to give it a shot. I've never come across it, honestly. I also have heard that it exists. I've never tried it. I would be totally open to trying it. And
And I'd be totally open to watching you try it. Yeah.
Me too. I'm with you, Doug. I'm like, yeah, I'll watch you eat it, but I don't know. You know, garlic is great, and it's got a lot of really healthy side effects.
Yeah.
You know, they have this huge list. I have this list that's too long to read. And there are scientists that are actually working on researching which of these things like colds or cholera or dandruff or asthma are really actually affected by garlic because garlic has a lot of antibacterial properties in it. So they say if you chop up garlic really fine and mix it in with your hamburger before you grill it, it could actually kill off any bad bacteria in there because it has these properties. So it's really, really a good thing for you to eat garlic. And I don't like garlic pills. You know, like that's not like eating garlic. Garlic is...
Garlic,
you got to eat it. And then when you sweat it out, you can repel mosquitoes without putting anything else on.
And maybe the husband.
Well, you know, speaking of that, I had heard at one time that, you know, the Germans from Russia, my tribe, the outsiders kind of stayed away from them because they stunk of garlic all the time.
Well, on a lighter note, or an even less light note, let's go that way. The farmers markets are starting to open up, so maybe people will start to see garlic scapes and know what they are now?
Absolutely. We have people that buy them by the garbage bag full because there are people that plant thousands of bulbs of garlic. And so this is one way we can extend our growing season or our production season also by taking advantage advantage of a few of these things. I've even heard of people who've let their radishes go to seed and then eating those seed pods that grow, sauteing those. So there's a lot of things, but, you know, we have to educate our customers because a lot of times the people in this state are pretty much meat and potato kind of folks, and so they probably cut those scapes off, or maybe they didn't cut those scapes off and threw them away back in the day. So.
Well, we learned something talking to Sue Belcom with the Root Cellars Farm near Mandan. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Great River Energy, powering what's possible by using new technologies to operate some of the most efficient power plants in North Dakota, helping to meet the energy needs of member consumers through reliable and affordable electricity and sound environmental stewardship.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, as we hit the midsummer mark, that is a big question because there's a lot going on. Ashley Thornburg and I are looking at our What's Happening list of things to do.
And how about this one? UFOs and extraterrestrials in Montana. This is a good day for it. Friday, July 13th, Friday the 13th. You want to go see some UFOs in Glendive, Montana at the Makashika Amphitheater. And so you can hear from a woman named Joan Bird, and she is going to be presenting about UFOs. Montana, you might not know this, is home to some of the most significant, well-documented, and interesting UFO reports in the history of ufology, UFOlogy. I'm not sure what that word is.
Works for
there,
me.
But yeah. You will get to learn more about that 7 to 8:30 p.m. Mountain Time in Glendive, Montana at the Makashika Amphitheater. And again, this is on Friday, and it's free.
Well, another opening, another show. Trollwood Performing Arts School presents Hello, Dolly. It opens tonight, runs Wednesdays through Saturday until July 28th. It's in Moorhead or south of Moorhead at the Imagination Amphitheater at Blue Stem Center for the Arts. Hello, Dolly is a musical theater classic based on Thornton Wilder's play The Matchmaker, and it features songs and dances and costumes that have made it a favorite for decades. The curtain is at 8:30 evenings, and tickets range from $10 to $32. Hello, Dolly is at Trollwood.
You can go swimming with the Big Sticks on Tuesday the 17th in Dickinson at the West River Community Center. This is the Badlands Big Sticks, and they're going to be in the outdoor pool on July 17th. And this is sort of a team event, so you'll want to meet them. And if you're a fan of the team, you get to go swimming. They'll be signing autographs, taking photos, and so much more. 2 to 4 p.m. on Tuesday the 17th in Dickinson at West River Community Center, and it's free.
I got another big musical, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Thursday, that is this evening, through Sunday in Bismarck at Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park, a longtime musical theater favorite that tells a biblical story in an innovative way with a cast of memorable characters and songs that endure. The curtain is at 8 o'clock. Tickets range from $10 for kids to $32 for adult reserve seats. Again, this is Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat this evening through Sunday in Bismarck at Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park.
You can paddle the Glendalough Chain of Lakes Saturday the 14th in Battle Lake at Glendalough State Park. This is in Minnesota, and you will be joined by experienced guides, and you get to go through three different lakes and a pristine creek that is connecting them. This is about a five-hour adventure, so make sure you are up to it. Bring sunblock, drink water. It is appropriate for beginners, though, so just bring along your $20. You can rent one if you don't have a canoe already for just $20. 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on a Saturday the 14th in Battle Lake at Glendalough State Park.
Jesse Veter will be performing this Saturday in Fargo at Island Park, one of North Dakota's favorite performers. The singer-songwriter will perform and sign copies of her CD and book. The music starts at 4 p.m. on Saturday, again in Island Park. Admission is pass the hat. Who can pass that up?
The Magic City Misfits presenting the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Usually you kind of see this one come up around October, but they're going to do it for Friday the 13th in Minot at the Sleep In Convention Center. This is a live performance of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Tickets are $15 and can be purchased at the door. This is part of the Minot Pride Festival. It gets going at 8 o'clock on Friday the 13th in Minot at the Sleep In Convention Center. And again, tickets starting at $15.
Another show to see in Bismarck, Capital Shakespeare, presents Richard III. It's running Wednesday, July 18th. That's next Wednesday through the 22nd Sunday. Bismarck on the Capitol grounds, one of Shakespeare's arch villains, ravages the English throne with his lust for power in Capital Shakespeare's modern production of Richard III. The show is at 7 o'clock. The cost is free, but of course, donations are welcome. This is an outdoor performance. The space accommodates lawn chairs and blanket seating. So check out Richard III, a Shakespearean classic, next Wednesday through Sunday in Bismarck on the Capitol grounds.
There's a bluegrass jam session this Saturday in Valley City at the Barnes County Museum. This is from 1 to 5, and it's acoustic-only jam set. So no matter what level, as long as you're playing an acoustic instrument, you can go show up at the bluegrass jam session Saturday the 14th in Valley City, 1 to 5 p.m. at the Barnes County Museum.
Halloween in July this year is at our villa in Turtle River State Park. It starts Friday, runs Saturday as well. Join in on a night of family-friendly fun. Bring your costumes and decorations for Halloween in July. Events include campfire stories, ghoul and goblin games, costume contests, campground trick or treat, and a movie. The events start at 8 in the evening on Friday, and again, that's repeated on Saturday. The cost is right. It's free.
The grand opening of the Pembina Gorge Terrain Park. That's going to be my pick of the week. That's coming up this Friday, the 13th in Wahala at the Pembina Gorge State Recreation Area. This is the grand opening, the first downhill mountain bike park in the state. Yes, you can mountain bike in select portions of the state, and this is a whole park open for that. There is going to be events going from 3 to 7 p.m., hot dogs, hamburgers, and it's possible that the granola bar my dad invented is going to be on hand.
Wow.
There. You should taste it. 3 to 7 p.m. in Wahala at the Pembina Gorge State Recreation Area, and it's free.
Well, here's my pick. It's much anticipated. Red River Market opens this Saturday and runs Saturdays through October in downtown Fargo at Broadway and 4th Avenue North. The summer market opens for the season with vendors selling fresh produce and crafts and food and beverages. Entertainment varies. This Saturday will feature Eric Jacobson and the Jazz Committee. And it starts at 10 in the morning, runs till 2 in the afternoon, and it costs whatever you choose to buy. Enjoy the Red River Market. And that's what's happening.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV, Friday night, enjoy another triple header of talented regional musicians on Prairie Musicians. Starting with the Viking, Minnesota-based reggae-tinged blues rock band, Chrome.
But I don't want none. I'm lost in a trouble.
Then it's the authentic songwriting and rooted Midwestern folk of the Jeff Krause Trio.
Twice the cost for whiskey, three times for the wine.
And rounding out the night, dynamic vocalist and songwriter Michael Shine.
He's falling further, but the lights take us on.
Enjoy an hour and a half of excellent music from your own backyard on Prairie Musicians. Friday night starting at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 12th. On a hot July morning in 1853, a group of hungry men were navigating the plains of North Dakota. As members of the Pacific Railway Survey, they were tasked with finding the best northern route for a transcontinental railroad. Led by Isaac Stevens, a distinguished engineer, the group consisted of soldiers, scientists, engineers, artists, and local guide Pierre Botineau. Stevens was scheduled to become the first governor of the territory of Washington. He chose to undertake the survey along the way. After 7 weeks of travel, food provisions were growing low. It would be another 7 weeks until they reached Fort Union, where they could restock. However, at the rate of their current consumption, their provisions would last only halfway. Every day at 2 a.m., the team's day began when the cooks lit the fires for breakfast. At 4, the soldiers were called to eat. During the meal, the animals were harnessed, and by 5 a.m., the camp was in motion. Even with the diminishing food supply, Stevens was hopeful. He knew after crossing the Bois de Sioux River on June 29th, they had reached the commencement of buffalo country. On today's maps, the Bois de Sioux is the border between North Dakota and Minnesota, south of Wahpeton. It's also where the rolling river valley opened up to the vast, treeless grasslands that fed the large herds of American bison. On July 10th, the group reached the shores of Lake Jesse near the Cheyenne River Valley. Here they first encountered the fabled buffalo. Stevens recounts the event, stating, "Ahead, every square mile seemed to have a herd of buffalo on it. Their number was variously estimated by the members of the party, some as high as 500,000. I do not think that it is an exaggeration to set it down at 200,000. I had heard of myriads of these animals inhabiting these plains, but I did not realize the truth of these accounts to this day when they surpassed anything I could have imagined." The group's guide, Pierre Botineau, set forth with a group of hunters. In less than an hour, a wagon was called to collect the choice cuts of meat from 9 buffalo cows. No longer concerned with the prospect of empty bellies, the team set forth again. By November, they would arrive at Fort Vancouver, near present-day Portland, Oregon, completing the survey for a railroad that would bring much change to the northern prairie. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Maria Witham. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
British Prime Minister Theresa May is hoping to strike a trade deal with President Trump. But how successful will Britain be with a president who's taken a tough stance with many of America's oldest allies?
Brits are looking at the demands that he's making on others and wondering whether, in fact, the offer of a US-UK trade deal is really possible at all.
The latest on President Trump's trip to the UK on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Before I tell you what's coming up on Main Street on Friday, this note. Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota is designating a social, which had been planned for tonight at Drecker Brewing, downtown Fargo, to become a fundraiser for disaster relief efforts for victims of the Watford City tornado. So that's, again, a social at Drecker Brewing, downtown Fargo, is now a fundraiser if you're interested in helping support that effort. Friday on Main Street. Earlier this week, NDSU held its fourth annual conference on food for health, and Bill Thomas will join us with some highlights. Our news director, Dave Thompson, will offer his insight on the week's big stories. And Matt Olean will review Won't You Be My Neighbor, a documentary about Fred Rogers. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.